Accession number 4384, Reel 4, of Mr. J. E. Sutton, November 1915 to October 1916.
Having an enjoyable stay and finished up the dinner at a musical show at Daly's Theatre. At Victoria Station the next morning, Major McDougall asked me to take care of his kit as he was returning to France. There was quite a commotion at brigade headquarters when the major showed up. Apparently he was on convalescent leave when he decided to return to France. However, he soon took command of the battery. Placed here proved to be a quiet sector, and we had no great difficulty maintaining communications. Food had improved somewhat with the issue of a new canned meat and vegetable ration. This turned out and cooked made a fair beef stew. Incidentally, we had a new cook. Tommy Berg was doing a creditable job, along with his assistant, Danny McDonald. Cooking was done in an outbuilding of a farm behind our guns. The work crew of the farm was one man and one cow. The cow furnished milk, pulled the plow, and hauled the loaded hand barrow. Grain was cut with a scythe and thrashed with a flail. Quite primitive, but it worked. Aerial observation had advanced to the point that both sides had planes in the air on clear days. These were open cockpit biplanes of wood, wire, and fabric construction with a single propeller. There were no dogfights, as these early planes were unarmed, manned by a pilot and an observer. They were a nuisance, as activity in the forward areas had to be restricted and gun positions camouflaged. A spotter was kept on duty at the guns. When an enemy plane was sighted, he blew a whistle to stop all activities, then gave two blasts when all was clear. Observation balloons were also used by both sides, sighted beyond the range of enemy guns. Their effect was to limit major movements on roads in forward areas to nights and bad weather days. Anti-aircraft fire from our side was by pom-poms, firing rapid bursts of 2-pound explosive shells. Not very effective. Enemy's anti-aircraft was from slightly heavier guns, but also ineffective. Enemy shell fire occurred daily on schedule with St. Ives Post Office and Postage Church as their main targets. On one occasion, they wasted about 20 rounds of 5.9-inch shells on an empty field to our left. These were the nearest enemy shells to fall during our stay of about 2 months in this position. The 2nd Canadian Division arrived in France during October and took over sector on our left during November. Three former Hornby classmates were in the 22nd Battalion from Winnipeg. Harry and Stanley Minter and Sid Widget were marksmen and were used as snipers. About mid-November, we moved about 2 miles west to a position right behind a hedge near the south end of Wishart Ridge. From here we were enfilading the German trenches about 2 to 2.5 miles away along the south end of Messines Ridge. We were firing almost west for the only time in the war. Wishart Ridge was wholly within our lines, about 300 feet high at the north end to about 40 feet ahead of our guns, this sufficient for flash cover. There was a ruined village named Wolverdom, also the remains of a chateau owned by Hennessy, the vintner of good brandies. The ridge was quite steep on the east face, but sloped down on the other side to the Doubs River. Our front line trench was practically at the bottom of the slope. The communication and support trenches had all caved in due to heavy rains. Our observing station was behind a hedge at the top of the ridge, but we had to keep a telephone in operation in the front line. We ran several lines with cross connections, but these were out of service every evening, as everything had to go across the open after dark. Found that after midnight was the only time to repair lines, when relief, ration, and ammunition parties were not busy and attracting enemy shell fire. The telephone station in the front line was a headache. It was manned by a signaler and two gunners relieved each evening. Repairing lines every night took 2 to 3 hours and was a risky, seemingly futile task. Wading through mud, dodging shell holes sometimes, at times getting tangled with some rusty barbed wire, ducking as low as possible whenever a flare went up. There were frequently a few shells bursting around and bullets whizzing past. After 2 weeks behind the hedge, we moved our guns back closer to the main road because of difficulty in getting up ammunition. Here we built gun positions in a hedge using some artificial camouflage. Field behind our guns had no shell holes and was used by the infantry as a football field. The farmhouse and buildings adjoining were undamaged and were the neatest and best built I have seen in France or Belgium. This was the home farm for the Hennessy Chateau. When off duty, we slept in a loft over the stables. Bunks had been built by the 118th Brigade, Royal Field Artillery. They had moved closer to their 12 4.5-inch howitzers firing over the crest. This general area behind Wishart Ridge had been free from enemy shell fire, as there were no suitable gun positions close to our front. The farm was still under cultivation. One day, a good crop of white turnips was pulled and tied in small bundles, complete with the tops. General Armstrong was sleeping off the effects of too many beers and soon got an estaminet about a mile down the road. Lying on his back, he looked very peaceful, and some wag got a bunch of turnips and laid them on his chest, carefully folding his hands on them. Major McDougall picked this time to inspect our quarters. His only comment when he saw the Armstrong layout was that he hoped the turnips would be returned to the farmer. After about 4 weeks of operation, the useless telephone station in the front line was abandoned. During this period, the dugout was hit several times by enemy shells. On one occasion, a signaler and one gunner were killed. On another, two men were slightly wounded. The PBI, short for Poor Bloody Infantry, served 4 days in the front line and 8 days out in rest. Dugouts were just holes in the side of the trenches. Our trenches were sometimes knee-deep in water whenever the Doubs River overflowed. Infantry companies, being relieved, were met at some distance back by a piper and a drummer. This was a great morale booster. Late in December, an armored car mounting 2 anti-aircraft pom-poms moved into our rear. The 4th Battery of our 1st Brigade went into action to our left front, and 6 6-inch howitzers manned by the Royal Garrison Artillery came in across the road to our rear. This concentration caused the Germans to move in a rear-mounted long-range 4.2-inch gun several miles to our right rear. This ended our immunity to shell fire. We were assigned the testing of a new instantaneous fuse in cutting the enemy barbed wire. This was known as Fuse Percussion with Cap number 106. I am quoting from an official handbook. The cap must be removed at the moment of loading. Premature action of the fuse is guarded against by a brass tape with weight being wound round a hammer below the head, which prevents any possibility of the needle striking the detonator until the tape has been unwound and flung clear by the centrifugal motion of the shell during flight. This is the end of quote. Ran a wire to the front line before dawn. I stayed on with Mr. Higgins and one signaler. Just before sunrise, we found that our wire had been cut, so I went back some distance and repaired the break. Got up to leave as a German sniper just missed with his first shot. I did not give him a chance for a second shot. Crawled through some barbed wire to an old caved-in trench, worked my way back to some ruined buildings and got back to our wire beyond rifle range. Tapped in and found that the line was intact. In getting through the barbed wire, I cut the first finger on my right hand to the bone. It was bleeding profusely, so I used my emergency bandage and walked back to the guns. The sergeant major took me to Major McDougall. I was a muddy, bloody mess. The major gave me a drink of rum and sent me to the field dressing station. Then gave me an anti-tetanus shot, bandaged my hand, and patched up a few other scratches. After an hour's rest, I reported back for duty. The major sent me to the horse lines to get a few days rest and a new uniform. Returned to the guns after 3 days and was told that I was relieved as a lineman and to take over as observer. This duty was to keep under observation enemy trenches and forward areas. This had been done by Bill Richardson, who was our number one director man. He had been given a commission in the Royal Field Artillery. One station was in a dugout behind a hedge, another in the ruins of an old mill, both on Wishart Ridge. From either, we could get a good view of the enemy's forward area. From the mill ruins, using a telescope, you could watch enemy soldiers in a certain section going about their daily tasks. Telephone lines were in service to both stations, and each contained a well-mapped sighting board showing lines and ranges to specified targets. Access was more difficult to the mill, as it was slightly on the forward slope, and there was only a shallow access trench. We were furnished by the infantry the location of enemy machine guns and trench mortars. Anything unusual was reported to the observing officer, who was also on the ridge. One day I spotted a gun flash from a forward gun in an area where we had noted some new work. This was checked with the infantry and they reported a 77mm shell from a gun at short range. Later, when the gun had proved a nuisance, it was shelled by the counter-battery guns and silenced. Early in the morning on 2 days, two German planes flew low over the ridge and spent a short time looking around. This was followed the next day by about 20 shells from their 4.2-inch gun. Some of these fell short of the road, but most in the field behind our guns. Next morning, one plane came over to see the results. When a few days passed without any shells, we hoped that something had happened to the gun, but no such luck. Starting about noon, the shelling continued for several hours. The field behind the guns looked like a pepper box, but no guns were damaged. The farmhouse and buildings were badly damaged, and the farmer and his family moved out. The roof of the building where we had been sleeping was destroyed, but we had no casualties. Next day, they were apparently trying for the 6-inch howitzers, which were on our right rear and possibly their prime target. They came very close, but apparently their field of fire was too narrow. We got our belongings out of the damaged buildings. The gunners slept in the gun positions, some off-duty signalers and others, including myself, moved into the basement of the farmhouse. This was very strongly built of brick and concrete with some steel beams, a window on a side toward the road, and an entrance with steps on the safer side. At the field dressing station, I had met an old friend from Toronto. Ray Grant had enlisted in the Queen's Own Rifles, our 4th Battalion, and had been transferred to the Canadian Army Medical Corps as an ambulance driver. He was on duty every other night. I slept in comfort in the back of the ambulance on those nights. Major McDougall asked permission to move the gunners to another location, but Colonel Mitchell looked the situation over and said we should stay where we were, but to build some sandbag shelters for sleeping between a hedge and some trees to our right rear. One evening, we were listening to some records played on a portable phonograph. Bill Richardson and myself had purchased this, and I had acquired his share. Usually there was no shelling after dark, but this evening was an exception. We had a man at the top of the steps to warn us of any close hits. You could hear the shell coming for several seconds, and when it started to fall, you could pick out any possible close hits. Finally, he shouted, "Here comes a close one," and ducked down the steps. The shell exploded about 2 yards from the top of the steps. The whole cellar shook and was filled with fumes. The candles went out and the needle went across the record, spoiling one of our best. We relit the candles and 5 men went out through the window. The 6th man named Fallis, usually called Fat Fallis for that reason, couldn't make it. 2 of those who got out were wounded by splinters from the next shell, which fell close to the road. We put on another record, but this was our last night in the cellar. I found a nice, warm, dry spot in a cow stable a short distance down the road. Used this on the nights when Ray Grant was not on duty. The British had found another service for some of their 15-pounder guns. Fitted with an improved recoil system and mounted on a revolving pedestal, the gun was mounted on a truck, which was solidly supported when in action. They were capable of getting off several shells per minute at angles up to 75 degrees from the horizontal and ranges up to 3.5 miles. Shells were 15-pound high explosives fitted with time fuses. It actually consisted of 2 guns with ammunition trucks, range finders, and other auxiliary gear. They were manned by Royal Horse Artillery officers and men, a very spit and polish regiment. A battery of these guns came into action about a mile down the road, close to the Estaminet, which was open 11 to 1 at noon and 6 to 9 in the evening. Drinks were French beer, quite bitter and very mild, sour red wine, and sweet syrups. Its only attraction for me was fried eggs and French fried potatoes served in a room off the bar. After eating one noon, I stopped to talk to some men who were drinking and watching a performance put on by a Highlander and a small goat. The man would take a drink of beer and the kid would give a ma. The Highlander would reach down and give the animal a drink of beer. This went on for some time after, and possibly before I came in. When closing time came at 1 p.m., the man stood up on rather unsteady legs, but the goat's legs were rubbery and collapsed. After several tries, the man said, "Come on, you drunken so-and-so," picked up the goat and staggered out. The Royal Horse Artillery personnel were lined up for inspection. The man stopped to watch and put down the goat, which promptly collapsed, and was picked up by his drinking partner, who stayed for the whole inspection. The men in the ranks had difficulty in keeping a straight face while the officer was inspecting each individual. Our any but low-flying planes. These were chased away by the pom-poms. I did not see any, but was told that three planes were shot down in 2 weeks before we left the area early in March 1916. Except for the one-day move from Placeit to the Wichita Ridge, we had been in action about 4.5 months. Casualties from enemy action totaled 6 men. From sickness and fatigue, chiefly older men, 16. I have previously referred to emergency rations. These consisted of a 1 pound can of corned beef, mostly from Argentina, a sealed metal can containing a few ounces each of tea and sugar, also 4 bouillon cubes. The pièce de résistance were 4 hardtack biscuits. These were about 3.5 inches square and about 1.5 inch thick, so compressed and so hard that if thrown against a brick wall, there would be no damage to the biscuit. They were carried loose in the haversack and were periodically inspected, and to be consumed only after orders. Soaking had no effect, so after several months' exposure, they had a nice muddy color and were as hard as ever. The infantry found that they could be burned to provide a little heat in damp dugouts. There was such a consumption that the quartermaster department investigated and banned the burning of hardtack. Charcoal and braziers were issued so that the hardtack biscuits performed some useful service. We moved to a rest area outside Hasbrook, spent a few days cleaning up guns, harness, and horses. We had our second official bath, were issued new underwear, socks, and shirts, and our uniforms were deloused. We held no mounted drills or maneuvers. Finally, we were inspected by General Morrison, the Canadian Artillery commanding officer. Went into action in a location known as Café Belge, at the southern end of the Ypres salient. A Belgian battery, armed with British 18-pounder guns, had moved out of a position to the right of the main road. We occupied an old British position to the left of the road. We made some much-needed repairs and rebuilt the gun pits. There were some reserve infantry dugouts in the woods to our rear. These got considerable attention from the German guns. The infantry told us that the Belgians would not fire at all for several days, then put on a burst of fire and withdraw their men to a safe distance when the Germans retaliated. Our targets were just north of the village of Zillebeck. A narrow gauge railroad ran through a cutting about 20 feet behind our front line. A high point in the German line gave them a good view of the approach to our trenches, and their guns would fire around or so at any party of more than 2 men. One afternoon, Major McDougall phoned to the observing station that he would be out for tea at 4 p.m. in the Zillebeck Railroad cutting. He did not arrive, and when he had not got there at 4:30 p.m., McDonald himself went back over the approach area. We did not find any trace of our commanding officer. Search parties combed the area at early morning and at dusk for several days. There were some fresh shell holes and some disused dugouts to the right of the trail to the observing station showed signs of recent hits. Major McDougall was reported missing, believed killed. Captain Green was promoted to Major. Early in April, I reported to Major Green, who told me he was recommending me for commission in the Canadian Field Artillery, and that I was to have 2 weeks' leave to England starting April 15th. I have no objections. The night of April 14th, Dick Wolf and myself waited at the cookhouse talking to Tommy Boyd and Danny McDonald until the ration wagon came up. Left in the wagon about 11 p.m., traveled for almost an hour back to our horse lines at Running House. Shells had hit quite near our horses. We were told that a wagon will be leaving at dawn for the way ahead at Paupering about 5 miles away. We decided in favor of leaving immediately on foot. Waited around for several hours at the railroad station while the Germans were sending over a few shells in the vicinity. Left about 8 a.m. after a cup of coffee and a bun at the canteen. Arrived at Boulogne and left about 11 a.m. for Folkestone. The sea was very rough, and our escort of two destroyers were rowing about 30 degrees each way as they ran circles around our boat. One broke away and exploded a floating mine with machine gun fire. We made it safely and finally got to London. It was a short walk from Victoria Station to the Pay and Records Office near the Houses of Parliament. We got some needed cash, £20 each, had dinner at a restaurant on the Strand. Dick Walker left on a night train to visit relatives. I stayed at the Strand Palace Hotel and left next morning for Herne Bay. Stayed at Holmesdale 3 nights. Went about Faversham to visit Great School. Dr. Telfer, the headmaster, had asked that I visit him, as he had been asked about my educational background. At lunch in his home, after meeting some of my former teachers and being introduced to the assembled student group, left for Canterbury, where my father was reconditioning some civilian quarters at the barracks. Canterbury Barracks had been the main depot for most of Britain's cavalry regiments. The Royal East Kent Mounted Rifles were camped on the parade ground. 4 Herne Bay friends were in one tent, one being Charlie Hawks, an upperclassman and a prefect at Rate School. Walking back to the hotel about 10:30 p.m., I was stopped by a sergeant of the Royal Military Police, who asked why I was out after hours and had one button unfastened on my coat. Showed him my leave warrant and told him the missing button was somewhere in the precedent. He invited me to his quarters, where we had a drink and talked until early morning. Went to Tunbridge to see my brother Charles. His regiment, the Buffs, were under orders to go to Ireland. Stayed 2 days, then went to London, where I stayed with the Butlers for the rest of my leave. At Victoria Station, a kilty was perched on a 6-foot-high fence, playing the bagpipes. People often ask, what is worn under the kilt? In this case, the answer was very apparent. Nothing. Had a smooth channel crossing, slept most of the train ride to Paupering. Got a ride on a truck to Runninghurst. Left about 9 p.m. on the ration wagon for the guns. The wagon was to stop at a supply dump to pick up some pit props and sandbags. Dick Walker and myself decided to take a shortcut across the field. A bursting shell hit near the wagon at a crossroad, wounding the driver slightly. Arriving at the guns, we were told that Tommy Boyd and Danny McDonald had been killed by a direct hit on the cookhouse. When I reported, I was sent to Major Green, who told me that I was to go back to the horse lines and help with the care of the last section horses as part of my training for commission. The slightly damaged wagon arrived, and the blanket wrapped remains of Tommy and Danny were sent back to the horse lines. The next day, the body bodies were buried in a military cemetery at Renninghurst. Trumpeter Mills sounded the last post, but there were no rifle salutes. A French priest led the short burial service. On our day off, was walking to Poplin with Corporal Stone. We met a captain of the Grenadier Guards. He returned our salutes, sat down, and asked us to join him in a cigarette. He did not tell us his name, but we recognized the Prince of Wales. He asked where we came from and how long we had been in France. We were very favorably impressed. He was a kindly, soft-spoken individual and very naturally genial. Had a good meal in the canteen, got some favorite pipe tobacco, and returned to Renninghurst. About mid-May, we went to a rest area to turn over our 18-pounder guns to a newly formed 59th Battery Canadian Field Artillery and to take over the 4.5 houses from the 458th Battery Royal Field Artillery. The Germans upset these plans by attacking and capturing Maple Copse. They practically annihilated two battalions of the Canadian Mounted Rifle Brigade of the 3rd Canadian Division. The 1st Canadian Division was moved in to retake this high point from which the enemy had observation of most of the guns in the Ypres salient. Until this time, all Canadian field artillery brigades consisted of four batteries, each armed with four 18-pounder guns, no 4.5-inch howitzers.